In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. Out of about 15 or so near-death experience testimonies I recently viewed, several people emphasized how they were sent back from the other side to deliver a message to humanity. The message is essentially that your thoughts, feeling, and intention create your reality. In one testimony, a woman was left to die from an overdose. Her body found amid the trash in an alley. She was hospitalized and revived. In one of her videos, she mentioned Neville Goddard's work that centers around exercises to focus your intention and create your own reality. Neville Goddard was a British Barbadian born in the West Indies in 1905. He was a writer, speaker, and mystic. Neville Goddard published up to 14 books, beginning with the 1939 book titled At Your Command. I'm thinking about why those on the other side need this message to reach people here in this incarnation, and why now? There are several past shows that have parallels with Neville Goddard's power of assumption and being in the wish-fulfilled state known to cause a shift in reality. Those shows also involve unique ways in using your mind, such as the interviews with Dr. Kahili King, author of Instant Healing, and Dr. Mary Hardy's work. On the opposite spectrum, past guest Jerry Marcinski reveals an active etheric parasite, not a chemical imbalance in the brain, but actual entities tormenting schizophrenics. There is a connection here with Goddard's work as well. Neville Goddard explains how being in the present moment in the wish-fulfilled state causes reality to reflect back, not what you want, but who you are. By assuming the conditions you wish to create, you then reshape your reality. This place of creation must include feeling, emotions, the language of the subconscious. When you imagine how it would feel in these wish-fulfilled states, the universe has no choice but to make it so. Goddard says, quote, "When fear knocks, answer with faith. When doubt creeps in, and it will, return to assumption." We'll be hearing from Goddard's presentation throughout this show while examining how reality rearranges itself to reflect back who we are being. We talk about these dynamics with our guest, Tom Montauk, who recently wrote an article titled, "How Can I Feel Myself to Be One with the Infinite Creator?" Tom Montauk is a seasoned researcher of fringe topics who draws on his scientific background to unravel the mysteries of reality. His website, montauk.net, that's MONTALK.net, covers 30 years of research into spiritual awakening, synchronicity, and the hidden mechanics of reality. Tom, welcome to Another News.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks so much for having me on.
For full disclosure, those tuning into this show have been listening to interviews with your partner, Carissa Conti, for many years, and it's an honor now as well to have you on. In the introduction, I mentioned how by watching near-death experience videos, several witnesses explained how they were sent back to tell people how important our thoughts, feelings, and intention are in creating our reality. Could there be a point of no return approaching as populations become tempted to rely on freely available experimental artificial intelligence tools? Is there a use-it-or-lose-it critical mass approaching? Or is there a significant deficit of humans not utilizing this important gift and are at risk of getting short-shrifted in life?
No, that's an excellent question, because we are at a pivotal moment in human history, actually, with the development of AI and robotics and all these new technologies coming online. And if we look historically at the trajectory of technologies and how it's influenced humanity, well, science and technology has gotten better, but spiritually, humanity has almost descended into a kind of dark age, right? Because if you consider like the medieval times, people back then, they had much better artistic imagination abilities. They were more spiritual. They had more complicated music. And nowadays you turn on the radio and the music is extremely simple and popular music is kind of base, I guess you could say. And people are in a more kind of nihilistic, lost, anti-spiritual state nowadays. So the question is, how will AI affect this? And in my opinion, I think AI is one of those tools where it's like a fancy calculator. So if you use it only as a fancy calculator for mechanical tasks like searching or summarizing or coding or analyzing, then it's okay, because that's a lot of drudgery that if you were to spend your entire day doing that, it would actually detract from you being able to be more yourself, be more creative. However, if you rely on AI too much for those things that should come from the soul, that should come from your imagination, then those abilities of your soul begin to atrophy. And that's a big risk that we're facing, because Neville Goddard mentions how important it is to use your imagination ability to shape the kinds of experiences that you attract to yourself in life. And that's not only true for you individually, but also for humanity collectively. So if collectively we lose our ability to go within and to tap into our spiritual power, then our lives will be entirely at the mercy of a technocratic, AI-driven reality. And that's not good either, because that puts the power into the hands of the people that control that system instead of our higher spirit. So that's sort of the crux that we are facing. So personally, I like using AI for mechanical things, but I swear to never ever use it for creative abilities like writing an article or coming up with new ideas, you know, brainstorming, writing music in my case. Now, some people do that, that's okay, but for me, I do want to preserve that ability within myself.
And I didn't mention that in your bio, but listeners, Tom Montauk is also a musician. While we're just briefly talking about this, Tom, can you tell listeners where to find some of the music that you're producing?
Oh, sure. So it's funny enough, even when I was a kid, I've always been into rock and metal and classical. So that trajectory has continued, and I make, well, essentially metal with some symphonic elements here and there. So if you're interested, you can go to my YouTube channel. Just look up Tom Montauk on YouTube, M-O-N-T-A-L-K, and you'll find my channel there. And I've got Fringe Knowledge videos. I have my album from 2011 and a couple songs since that time, and a few more projects that I'll be adding over time.
Recently, looking at some videos where people are posting AI videos that are known to elicit an emotional response from people. And there was one criticism I heard that some of the messages she got back from her criticism about, I don't know if it's okay for these AI productions to zero in on specific pieces of music or art that will guarantee to bring the human emotion out, to bring tears to somebody. There's just something wrong about that. It's almost as if the AI is using people to elicit emotion. Do you have a comment on that?
Yeah, I think one of the fundamental reactions that people have against that is that it's technology intruding upon something sacred, something personal. Because emotion, feelings, they come from the soul, you know? And if technology replicates that artificially without any human doing that, then it's almost a crime against the spirit to have essentially a rock, you know, silicon, which gets turned into a CPU or GPU, which, you know, runs the AI. It's kind of sacrilege for that to enter the inner spiritual sanctum of our soul and draw emotion out of it. I think that's what's happening subconsciously with people when they react to it. Now, in my opinion, I think just, you know, the same way that if you want to communicate a certain emotion through singing, for example, you're using your mechanical voice box in your throat, using your larynx to do that, and someone hears it with their mechanical ears, and it gets translated into a soul impulse, you are indeed working through a kind of mechanical system to do that. And AI is sort of like that. So I think the only way to use it correctly is if the artist has full command over the AI and uses it to express their own inner soul impulse, so that it's not just a blind machine coming up with it on its own, but it's doing the command of its creator, you could say. I think that's the only way that you could sort of justify that.
It's a new frontier of ethical and moral, you know, evaluation here. I mentioned earlier we're going to play parts of Neville Goddard's presentation, and let's have a listen.
To act as if you are the luckiest person in the world is to assume that nothing is out of place, that even your delays are divine, that even rejection carries redirection, that life is always conspiring in your favor, though you may not always see the hand moving behind the curtain. You begin to look at closed doors not as defeat, but as God's protection. You don't just wish for good things, you claim them. You prepare for them, you give thanks for them before they arrive. Attitude becomes your secret weapon. You no longer wait for blessings to show up to say thank you. You start with thanksgiving, knowing that what you appreciate appreciates. Every step you take becomes infused with the power of unseen faith, and life in turn cannot help but respond. Circumstances shift. People are drawn to your energy. Solutions come from unlikely places. Not because you forced them, but because you expected them. And here is where many go wrong. They wait to feel lucky until something lucky happens. But that's not how the law works. You must feel it first. You must embody it now. You must enter the mood of answered prayer before the evidence shows up. That's the sacred order. Assume the feeling of being divinely favored, and the world will bend to make it true. You do not need to be born into privilege to live a privileged life. You only need to awaken to your power to choose your assumptions right now, this very moment. You could begin to walk through this life as if the heavens are open over you, as if every room you enter is already prepared to receive you, as if every situation is turning in your favor, even if it doesn't look like it yet. That's the power of assumption. That's what it means to act as if you are the luckiest person in the world. So take a breath, let go of appearances, and step into the reality you desire, not by waiting for it, but by living in the state of it right now. Because when you do, the world cannot help but mirror your inner world. You are not a victim of fate, you are its author. What you accept inwardly, life must express outwardly. And the moment you claim without doubt, I am the luckiest person in the world, life must respond with proof. Not someday, not after you've earned it, but the moment you believe it. There is a secret place within every human being where the script of life is written, not by fate, not by accident, but by the quiet, often unnoticed power of assumption. To the outside world, life appears to unfold by chance. Some are deemed fortunate, others not. Some rise with ease, others fall without warning. But beneath this surface illusion, a spiritual law operates with absolute precision. It is the law that whatever you assume to be true, consistently and with feeling, must eventually become your experience. This is not philosophy. This is not positive thinking. It is spiritual causation. To act as if you are the luckiest person in the world is to deliberately plant the seed of that assumption into the fertile ground of consciousness, trusting that it must grow into reality. Everything begins in the mind. Long before the world sees it, you must feel it. Long before your hands touch it, your spirit must hold it. You do not need proof to assume something as true. You only need to accept it in your imagination. And here is the mystery. When you accept it as truth within, your outer world rearranges itself to reflect it. The world is not resisting you. It is responding to you. Every event every person, every so-called coincidence is shaped by the inner tones of your being. So if you walk through life assuming lack, you will experience lack. If you carry the belief that others are lucky but you are not, life will echo that back to you with precision. But the moment you shift, the moment you begin to dwell in the state of being favored, blessed, and divinely lucky, you awaken the law of reflection, and life must yield to the new truth you've accepted. The assumption is not wishful thinking. It is not idle daydreaming. It is a spiritual act, a declaration of what is, even before the world confirms it. When you assume you are lucky, you are not hoping that something good might happen. You are stepping into the reality where it already has. You are declaring within yourself that the good you seek is already yours. This assumption becomes the mold through which life pours itself. You cannot expect water to take shape without a vessel. Likewise, you cannot expect life to deliver what you have not first claimed within. Now ask yourself, what have you been assuming about yourself in silence? When no one is around, when the distractions fade, what do you quietly believe to be true about your destiny? Do you assume that life is against you? That things never work out for you? That others get chosen and you get overlooked? These beliefs, even if unspoken, are powerful. They are not passive, they are creative. And they are constantly forming the outer pattern of your days. But here's the beauty. You can change them. You can revise them. You can begin this very moment to assume something higher, truer, more aligned with divine favor. You can begin to act as if the stars are aligned for you, as if doors are opening that no one can shut. As if everything you need is already on its way, drawn by the gravity of your own belief. Do not wait for life to show you evidence before you believe. That is the way of the world, but not the way of the spirit. The law is not see and then believe. The law is believe and you shall see. This is the secret known by all who live uncommon lives. They do not wait for conditions to be perfect. They create those conditions by assuming them. They walk into rooms as if they belong. They approach opportunities as if they are already there. They carry a quiet confidence, not rooted in arrogance, but in the inner knowing that they are aligned with something greater than themselves. To assume you are the luckiest person in the world is not to deny reality. It is to reshape it. It is to go beyond appearances and choose a higher truth. You are not bound by your past. You are not defined by statistics, circumstances, or the judgments of others. You are defined by what you claim within. And when you claim divine favor, when you embody the feeling of being blessed, the world cannot help but follow suit. It has no choice. The world is clay. Your assumption is the hand that molds it. Every morning you rise is an invitation to create anew. Will you assume the worst out of habit, or will you dare to assume the best out of faith? Will you rehearse old disappointments, or will you imagine new beginnings? The choice is yours. And the moment you choose differently, the moment you say, I am not unlucky, I am divinely guided, I am fortunate beyond reason, I am the magnet for miracles, something begins to shift. You won't see it all at once, but slowly, and then suddenly, life starts echoing back what you whispered to yourself in silence. And if doubt creeps in, and it will, return to the assumption. When fear knocks, answer with faith. When the old story returns, rewrite it. Stand guard over your inner world, for that is where everything begins. And once the seed of assumption is planted and nurtured with belief, life itself becomes the garden in which it blooms. What the world calls luck is often misunderstood, reduced to a roll of the dice, a twist of fate, a chance encounter that no one could have predicted. People admire it when they see it in others, envy it when it seems absent in their own lives, and speak of it as if it belongs to a chosen few.
And that was a part of Neville Goddard's presentation. He continues here about stepping out of the world's chaos and how irrelevant the chaos actually is to your internal alignment. And everyone knows how much the corporate media wants you to embody the chaos, suggesting your outcomes are incoherent and random. British investigative journalist and author Jenny Randles wrote in her book titled Time Storms, quote, "In essence, matter was found to comprise a flux, a myriad of energy fields whose complex interactions created what to our eyes often appear as particles. Nevertheless, this discovery proved that at a fundamental level, all reality was immaterial and not rock solid, but in truth, a sea of invisible radiation energy in the form of waves," end quote. Is the fabric of our reality a pliable substrate for our conscious minds to interface with? Or, asked a different way, is the human mind designed to interface with the pliable substrate made up of waves at the subatomic level? Tom, would you please talk about what may be happening on a metaphysical level when a person correctly embodies the wish-fulfilled state, holds it, and causes reality to rearrange itself?
Well, that really is the crux of the topic that we're discussing, because this is the mechanism that makes it all work. So we have to understand possibly how it could work in order to give credence to the idea of Neville Goddard's technique. Okay. So what Jenny Randles is talking about there, she's talking essentially about quantum physics, quantum field theory, the standard model, the idea that when we look around and we see solid matter around us, that solidity is ultimately an illusion, because if you were to zoom in far enough, you would see nothing but vibrations, waves, energy, fields. Okay, there's no actual like solid particles. It's just fields and little excitations in those fields. However, all that quantum stuff, that's merely the last step in a sequence of steps that initially begins within the realm of greater consciousness outside of physicality. So I think one of the best ways to understand that reality is ultimately vibration, energy, and consciousness is to think about how things work inside your nightly dreams, okay? So when you're in your dream, you, the dreamer, all the characters in your dream, and the dream environment, those are all different facets or projections of the same exact consciousness, which is you. So all of it is happening inside of you, and yet you feel different. You feel different from all the different dream characters, from your dream environment, but it's all the same thing. So when you're in a dream, okay, what happens if you were to just relax, focus, call up a particular emotion or wish, and you immerse yourself into it, into that energetic template? Well, what happens is the dream itself begins to change to reflect that. And how does it do that? Well, it's because when you focus upon a particular idea or visual or emotion, it percolates down into your subconscious, which is generating the dream environment, and then percolates back up into the dream environment. So you're literally looking at your intentions, your emotions manifesting outwardly in the dream, but it can only work because it's all happening within your soul or your consciousness. So now consider then what happens in the waking world that we all share. Well, it turns out that yes, Buddhists and Hindus and native traditions all over the world say everything is part of a single great spirit. Everything is part of a single universal mind, you could say. But it's more complicated than that, because it's not just a universal mind. There's also a kind of universal subconsciouswich the ancient Greeks called the demiurge. And this demiurge is like the soul of the universe. It's like the subconscious of reality. And it is what projects and fashions the physical environment that we find ourselves within. Just as our own subconscious does within dreams, this demiurge does to all of us in waking reality. So actually, you know, there is not much of a difference then between a dream and reality, other than the fact that we have a bigger, more universal subconscious projecting this space, holding it all together, and making it way more persistent and logical and precise, you know, with physics and biology and chemistry and all those mathematical laws, than our own nightly dreams. So In that sense, our own nightly dreams are more like a low-resolution, small-scale AI model that generates an environment, whereas in waking reality, you've got the supercomputer, as a metaphor, the supercomputer generating reality with a lot of persistence and so on. However, our own subconscious is actually tied into the universal subconscious the same way that a single tree in a forest is tied into the entire forest through the root system. So when you turn within and you access your subconscious, or you impress a particular vision or emotion or deep assumption or belief upon it, it kind of goes down into the very root of your being and through that root system into the greater demiurge that affects all of reality. And so in that way, by changing your own subconscious, you change your external reality. Now, the difference, of course, between, as I mentioned, between your nightly dreams and waking reality is that waking reality has this, you know, universal thing, and we are all together in this reality, sharing it together. So it's kind of like everyone being tied together by a rope. We're all in a coupled system. So therefore, things happen a little bit more slowly in reality than they do in our nightly dreams. But they still happen. So it just takes a little bit more time. It might be a little bit more indirect, but it still happens. And that's sort of the key to understanding how this can work and why Neville Goddard's techniques are effective if you apply them correctly.
I like the forest, the tree roots of the forest connection, because that references the mycelium of the fungus, right? Connecting all the roots in the forest as the medium communication. And the supercomputer of the brain, the conscious mind interfacing with reality, not in the dream state, just in the waking life. Goddard said it in a presentation how an event took place where I think it was a Navy ship or some kind of cargo ship was hijacked and taken over. Big event in the news. And he was pointing out how several weeks before, a woman wrote a piece of fiction that detailed the exact event. And he is saying, is it possible this woman created that reality in her fictional article, that, you know, one of her courses in university? And it made me think, Tom, about these weird books that we see on Amazon that were published before like a big event that have all these false flag things attached to it. It speaks to the power of the conscious mind that may have this extra part imbued with emotion that may create a reality. We may not be aware of this.
Yeah, this is actually a well-known thing within the field of writing novels. Like, so novelists, it's sort of a thing that a lot of times they will encounter in the real world a character that they completely made up for a novel that they wrote years or months earlier. And the thing is, sometimes these characters are quite specific, even improbable, you know, kind of fantastical. But still, they will encounter it in the real world, which is really strange. Like, how can that happen? Well, it does make perfect sense. So if we are sharing a kind of collective dream, and if you energize a particular thought enough, it can be input into this universal subconscious and eventually, over time, pop up in your life. You know, it's crazy to consider, but that can definitely happen. Now, in other cases, of course, maybe a person was clairvoyant or precognitive and they just tapped into a future that was already on its way. You know, that's possible too. However, with precognition, you're only tuning into what could happen or what will happen, whereas with Goddard, we're talking about something where you can choose what you want to happen, and you do a certain kind of thing, the techniques that he talks about, and it manifests, okay? I mean, whether you do it intentionally or you do it unintentionally. Like, a novelist, when they're writing, they're really they're immersing themselves in that fictional world, right? So, because they imbue it with thought, with emotion, and they're almost in a kind of trance state when they're writing, well, those are the three ingredients that you need to make this work. So, really, from a technical viewpoint, it's no surprise that people who write things very often, well, I don't know how often it is, but it's not uncommon. Let's call it that. So it's not uncommon that they will manifest the very thing that they've been imagining very intensely.
We do have another part of Neville Goddard's presentation to listen to, and we're going to go now to that. Let's have a listen.
When you walk in alignment, your steps are guided. not by external forces, but by the quiet power of your own assumption. There is a spiritual current running beneath the surface of all things, and when you come into harmony with it, you are carried not by struggle, but by flow. You meet the right people at the right time. You receive unexpected news that opens new doors. You find yourself in places that seem too perfect to be planned, and the outside world watches and says, how lucky they are. But the truth is, you are not lucky. You are aligned. This alignment begins in the invisible realm of your own consciousness. It begins when you stop doubting that you are worthy of good, when you stop resisting your own desires, when you stop asking if it will happen and begin to live as though it already has. When your emotions, your self-talk, your imagination, and your expectations all move in the same direction, you become unstoppable. You no longer contradict yourself. You are no longer asking for one thing while expecting another. Your entire being becomes a single yes, a single affirmation of the life you choose to live. And when that happens, you draw that life to you with a force more powerful than effort, because belief works faster than effort. But this kind of alignment requires discipline, not physical discipline, but spiritual discipline. You must train yourself to remain in the state of the wish fulfilled, even when appearances suggest otherwise. You must choose to feel lucky before there is evidence. You must walk with your head high when your circumstances still look low. You must give thanks for blessings that haven't yet arrived in the physical, knowing that they already exist in the unseen. This is not delusion. This is creation. For everything that is seen was first born in the unseen. Your inner alignment becomes the mold through which the outer world takes shape. You will know you are aligned when peace replaces panic, when trust replaces tension, when your inner conversation begins to echo the same truth as your desired outcome. You won't need to chase, convince, or struggle. You will attract, magnetize, and manifest. People will call you lucky, but you will know that what they see is simply the fruit of what you have believed. The world will marvel at your timing, your synchronicities, your breakthroughs. But you will remember the private moments when you chose to believe, when you sat in silence and imagined a new outcome, when you refused to accept defeat as final, when you stepped into the energy of the answer long before it arrived. And the beauty is, anyone can live this way. You do not need a perfect background, a prestigious education, or external validation to become lucky. You need only begin the sacred work of aligning your inner world with the truth of your divine favor. You need only start believing that you are already blessed, that your life is unfolding with divine precision, that what you seek is already seeking you. This belief must not be passive. It must be lived, breathed, walked, and felt. It must become the air you breathe and the tone of your imagination. And as this belief deepens, so too does your alignment. You move from hoping to knowing, from wishing to embodying, from waiting to receiving. This is how life transforms, not through force, but through faith. Not by manipulating the world, but by harmonizing with the unseen laws that govern it. And when that harmony is achieved, when the sound of your inner world matches the rhythm of divine favor, life sings in your favor. What once seemed like coincidence becomes confirmation. What once felt delayed arrives with speed. What once felt out of reach enters your hands with grace. You don't have to wonder how or when, you simply know. You act, speak, walk, and live as if it is already done, because in the realm of spirit, it is. The outer world is only catching up to what you have already become within. And to the outside observer, it will always look like luck. But to you, it will feel like home. To live from the end is to occupy in your mind and emotions the state of already having what you desire. It is a radical departure from the way most people move through life. Most live toward their goals. They wait for the world to change before they feel differently. They measure progress by external signs. But the spiritual truth is this: you are not waiting on life. Life is waiting on you. The outer world is simply a mirror, echoing back the assumptions you accept as true. And when you live from the end, you flip the entire structure of experience. You no longer ask, how do I get there? Instead, you dwell in the place where it is already done. You feel it, you taste it, you imagine it so vividly that the world begins to conform to the inner script you are already living out in your imagination. This approach is not about pretending. It is not about ignoring the present or denying what's in front of you. It's about understanding that the present circumstances are simply the residue of old beliefs and past assumptions. They are not fixed. They are not final. They are not stronger than the creative power that lies within you. When you live from the end, you claim your role as the author of your reality. You are no longer reacting to the world, you are causing it. And every thought, every feeling, every inner conversation becomes a seed planted in the fertile soil of consciousness, destined to sprout in due time. Consider how the world is structured to make you live reactively. You are taught to wait, to prove yourself, to meet conditions. You are told that only one certain criteria are met. Once you have the degree, the job, the relationship, the approval, then you can finally feel successful, loved, happy, or free. But spiritual law invites you to reverse this. Feel the freedom first. Feel the love first. Feel the success first. When you live in the feeling of your desire fulfilled, without contradiction or doubt, you are in alignment with that reality, and the world must catch up. The mind may argue and say, but I don't see it yet. That is where faith begins. You do not live from the end because you see it. You live from the end so that you will see it. The unseen comes first, always. Every visible result in your life began in the invisible realm of thought and feeling. Nothing is random. Nothing is imposed upon you. Everything is rooted in the state of consciousness you occupy. So if you want to change the outer, you must first inhabit the inner state where the desire is already fulfilled. That's where power is. That's where transformation begins. To live from the end means you no longer seek permission to believe. You no longer wait for encouragement. You step into the version of yourself who already has it. And you let that version lead. You ask not, can I become this? But how would I think, speak, and act if I already were? You begin to align your choices, your posture, your energy with the person who is no longer striving, but simply being. And that shift changes everything. Because the world responds not to your words, but to your state of being. It responds to who you are, not what you want. This is why so many remain stuck. They live toward their desires, which means they're always in a state of lack. They are chasing, reaching, hoping, waiting. Their inner dialogue reinforces the distance between them and their goals. But when you live from the end, you collapse that distance. You move from someday to now. Your imagination becomes your sanctuary. In it, you rehearse the scenes of your ideal life, not as a wish, but as a memory. You walk through the corridors of your mind, already possessing what you desire. You touch it in your imagination. You smell the air. You feel the emotions. You create the vivid inner experience so deeply that it begins to feel natural. And once something feels natural, it must become real. This way of living requires intention. You must withdraw your attention from appearances and dwell in the unseen. You must refuse to be discouraged by delay. You must learn to ignore what contradicts your inner knowing. Because when you live from the end, you begin to see the world through a different lens. Everything becomes a part of the unfolding, even the detours. Even the silence, even the apparent setbacks. You are no longer shaken by what you see because you know what you have already claimed within. The world is just catching up. There is great peace in living this way. You no longer carry the weight of uncertainty. You no longer wonder if you're worthy. You have already decided. You have already assumed your place. You begin to feel gratitude, not for what is coming, but for what has already arrived in your imagination. And this gratitude, this inner thanksgiving, becomes a magnet. It pulls the invisible into the visible. It bridges the gap between spirit and matter. And slowly, without strain, life reshapes itself to mirror the state you have consistently occupied.
If you're just tuning in, our guest is Tom Montauk, and he is a seasoned researcher on fringe topics. We're talking about the work of Neville Goddard and manifesting reality. Tom, here again, Neville Goddard is repeating a concept in many different ways that by holding the wish-fulfilled state, reality will begin to align with the inner state of being. Past guest, Dr. Mary Hardy, calculates an astronomical measurement showing how sensitive our thoughts and intentions are. In her book, titled Pyramid Energy, she writes about how the weak fields of electromagnetic energy constantly modify the relationship with our surroundings. The significance of telepathy, she writes, quote, is but a response to a very weak electromagnetic signal. Early measurements suggested the average neuron synapse energy interchange is in the order of 10 to the 15th power of a watt. And those early measurements are from universities in the UK and the United States. For reference, the output of a single candle flame is internationally given in the spherical measurement as 0.1847931 of a watt. This number now must be diminished by 10 to the 15th, or 0.000, that's 15 zeros, 1846931. So she writes, if one candle's light is gathered in a spherical condition and taken as one, then we can interpolate that the human brain responds to a signal of 100 trillion times smaller. Now we can see the relationship of true sensitivity. Such small, weak fields move incredibly fast. It is the sensitivity, she writes, of all creation to all creation, which is the only path to true progress. In a nutshell, one can speak, write, or think whatever one likes, but unless it is an action, word, or thought conceived in humble, simple love, it is wrong. We're all mostly unaware of this staggering measurement of our own sensitivity, yet Dr. Hardy emphasizes and holds you accountable to an ethical standard. With this innate ability, Tom, and based on your research into this world of manifestation and multiple aspects of spirituality, would this spiritual law Goddard references also allow the creation of negative and foul manifestation?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So before I get into that, I do want to address what she said about the incredibly small amount of power that our neurons operate on. So it's interesting because besides electromagnetism, there are other forms of energy or waves that exist. One example being what's called the quantum potential or Bohmian potential. It's a facet of the quantum wave function, which is the waves that underlie reality. It's a facet of that which does not diminish with distance. So you can have an electron on the other side of the universe having a quantum potential that affects a couple neurons in your brain here, okay? So what that means is that everything is connected and interacting at a quantum level. Interestingly enough, the power of thought, including the power of telepathy, it's not so much about raw power, like, you know, getting on a megaphone and yelling really loudly to reach someone a couple hundred yards away. It's not about power. It's more about coherence, alignment, and synchronization. So you can think of it like a tiny key and a little turn of the wrist can open a giant vault door, which a huge sledgehammer, you could beat on the door all day and you're not going to open it. So raw power isn't always a solution to everything. Sometimes it's about having the right code to access a specific function. And that really is the essence, I think, of Goddard's technique. and how consciousness interfaces with the brain, like how the soul, the spirit, interfaces with the biological brain, it's not strictly through raw power. It is through having the right access codes or the right interactions to be able to specifically influence a very sensitive system, which is what the human brain is. It's a very sensitive system. So I just wanted to talk about that a little bit. So back to your question then, you asked whether the occult laws of manifesting allows also for the creation of negative and foul manifestations. So there are different kinds of negative manifestations. The simplest one is where you attract situations in life that are very suffering-inducing, that are very harrowing to go through. You know, negative experiences, accidents, illness, misfortunes, fights, breakups, things like that. A lot of these very painful experiences, they can be attracted more than they need to be. Because on the one hand, right, there's a lot of people that say, if I had to do it all over again, I would do it all over again because it made me stronger as a person. So a lot of times pain and suffering can make us better. But I think we also have the freedom to attract more of it than is necessary for our own good, especially in the sense that it wastes a lot of time and energy, and maybe we could have become stronger in a shorter period of time, but because we were stubborn and in this negative feedback loop, we attracted more of it than we should have. So that's one example of doing it. And the way that would work, for example, is if you spend most of your day, especially after you wake up in the morning and you're laying there and you're kind of ruminating in your mind about all your problems, your fears, your anxieties, your resentments and hatreds of this person or that person, if you get into that mode, especially in that half awake, half asleep state, that is the most effective way to manifest reality. And except for in this particular case, you're doing it in a negative way because you're latching onto all those probable futures that reinforce more of those same emotions and feelings and thoughts and beliefs. So it's important to understand that the way our reality works is it works almost like a, well, it does work like a feedback loop system where the experiences that we have tempt us to think about them or react to them in a certain way. And we have free will choice about how to do that. I mean, if you experience a misfortune, do you react by becoming extremely freaked out, even more negative, even more depressed, you know? Or do you say, well, it is what it is. I have faith that it's going to work out and I'll do my best to make it work out. See, those are two opposite approaches to the exact same experience. And which one you choose reinforces its corresponding feedback loop. So if you choose the positive approach, then maybe the next time an experience like that comes, it'll actually work out this time. And then you'll feel better. And then because you feel better, it'll make the next one work out even better. And eventually you don't even get them anymore, right? So through this feedback loop mechanism, you end up shifting towards a more positive timeline for yourself. Or conversely, you can go down the negative path, and that becomes like a snowball rolling down a hill and gets worse and worse and worse. So we have to take control of our feedback loops by deciding whenever we're confronted with these challenges how we're going to react to it. And ideally, we would react to it in a positive way. So attracting negative experiences like that, that's one form of foul manifestation that you're alluding to. But there is also another form which gets more into the field of occultism and the topic of thought forms, tulpas, or what are called egregores. And what these are subtle energy constructs, almost like little AIs that can take the form of beings, entities, little astral animals or something, but they're non-physical constructs that are the emanations of your own soul energy that take external form within the non-physical energy field environment that we are surrounded by, you know, because there's a physical plane, but there's also other planes that are stacked atop that, which we can't see with our eyes. But if you're psychic or you go out of body or you have a near-death experience, then you can experience these other parallel invisible planes that are around us. And our thoughts and our feelings can create these thought form type entities in this plane. So, and the way that they're created is through focused thought, focused emotion, and also focused belief, you know, very much like Goddard's technique. So what happens then is that if you steep yourself in extremely negative emotions and thoughts and feelings for a long time, and not just negative in the sense of depression, but also any kind of base emotion that animal desires, greed, envy, hatred, those kinds of things, if you do that for too long, too often, it can create, an, as I mentioned, an externalized thought form entity that takes on a life of its own. And this entity then becomes parasitic and tries to make you, through a kind of telepathic or psychic influence, make you engage in more of those same behaviors that create more of that energy that it then feeds upon. And it can become so strong that it doesn't even need to feed on you anymore. It's now strong enough to affect other people in your vicinity and make them engage in those kinds of behaviors. So negativity in that sense can spread, and that ties into the Native American idea of the Wendigo or Wetiko, which Paul Levi talks about. He talks about this idea of this dark etheric parasite, and also Marzinski, that's what he talks about as well. These etheric thought forms, or demons, as you might want to call them, whatever they are, they have the ability to be created by one person and spread to others. Or, you know, maybe they are not created by us, but they are something more primordial. But either way, these are precisely, exactly, foul manifestations, spiritually foul manifestations that can have a parasitic effect on you individually and also on humanity as a whole. And that's why it is actually in the interest of the dark powers that be, not just the human psychopaths that run government and corporations, but also occult powers that are not even physical. It's in their interest that humanity gets as spiritually beat down as possible and focus as much on animal desires and negativity as possible in order to generate these parasitic thought forms that then create a feedback loop which keep us even more down, make us even more victims, and therefore make these predators stronger and stronger and stronger. So if there's any like major takeaway that we can get from Goddard, it is that we as individuals and as collective humanity need to take control of our creative abilities and practice spiritual hygiene and make sure that we are spinning up these positive feedback loops that can move us towards a more positive future.
I didn't even think about the unintentional, the unwitting thought form that mutates into this apparition eventually. I really don't think about that because it's almost taking Carl Jung's theory on the shadow and animating it as something that becomes real, breaks out of the cage in effect. So that's the unintentional and unwitting part there. Can somebody interface with the quantum substrate intentionally cause harm to other people?
Yeah, they can definitely do that. And that's what black magic really is. Psychic attacks, spiritual warfare. People can do it. Dark occult masters are very effective at that. And also non-physical dark beings, which some people might call demons. They can do such a thing. I mean, that's what they specialize in, because being non-physical, it's not like they have to go to work and pay taxes and, you know, do all the boring stuff we have to do. They dedicate their time to perfecting the art of spreading spiritual darkness in this world, if not this entire universe. So that's what they can do. And what it means, therefore, is that metaphysics, the structure of reality, occultism, all that stuff, it's a neutral medium, it's a neutral tool that can be used for good or for evil, depending on the free will of the being doing it. Now, in our case, if we're talking strictly about thought forms, they are not really sentient, they're more like artificial intelligences, so they don't really have free will, they just have programming that is imbued into them by who? By us. By us reinforcing them, creating them through very intense, prolonged thoughts, feelings, and beliefs. And so these things, they act as what in chaos theory is called a strange attractor. And what a strange attractor is, it's a kind of energy field that bends probability towards itself. So, for example, if you were to create a thought form of depression, either on purpose or unintentionally, then this thought form will have the effect of inducing depression in anyone it comes in contact with. So, you know, that's how particular emotions can spread. And what you're asking about is whether that can be done intentionally, and the answer, of course, is yes.
Tom, you and Carissa had produced a multi-part podcast on manifesting and how reality works. Please tell listeners more about this.
Right, so my girlfriend Carissa and I, we put together this multi-part podcast series on manifesting, on reality creation, how reality works, all the nuances and anecdotes and cool stories to back it up that I can only allude to here. So anyone who wants to know more, who wants to get like a master class on how this stuff works, definitely check that out on my YouTube channel. It's called The Mind Over Reality.
That's going to do it for the first part of this interview with Tom Montauk, our guest. He is a longtime researcher on a range of topics who really draws on his scientific background in electronics, engineering, and physics to go deep into the mysteries of reality. His website is montauk.net, M-O-N-T-A-L-K.net. And we're talking about the work of Neville Goddard and the potential factory recall here in a message being sent from the other side about the true potential of our ability to create our reality. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.